better.
Hot Flavor and Commerce, please come to order.
Do what?
It's May the 15th, about 8:20 in the morning. I note the presence of Representative Ewing, Representative Furness, Representative Winstead, myself, Representative Cowdery, co-chair. There are four bills scheduled to be heard in committee today, and because of the complexity of some of these bills, we may not be able to hear them all today, and if we are not finished with the legislation today, it's my intention to recess so we can reschedule a meeting in the very near future to deal with the rest of the bills. And we'll continue to, until it works probably until about 5 or 10 minutes before 9. The first piece of legislation is first piece of legislation to be heard is Senate Bill 525. It's an act related to unemployment insurance. And the main purpose of this bill is to bring the state's unemployment insurance laws into conformity with federal laws. It also would increase weekly unemployment benefits and calls for a new method of calculating the unemployment tax that employers pay. This is just a brief outline for a very complex bill. We have studied the bill, and just for the committee's information, we find that certain school employees, for instance, the custodian and school bus drivers, and perhaps some of the secretarial staff are omitted, or they are not allowed under this bill to draw unemployment insurance during the 2 months that they're off during the season, during the interim. There's 1,400 of these people throughout the state, and they're low income type people anyway. And I've talked with the Department of Labor, and I think we came up with an amended bill that will address those. So with that, I'd ask the Department of Labor to come forward and testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, my name is John W. Jack Shea. I'm the Director of Employment Security Division of the Department of Labor. And the bill you have before me, as your chairman has pointed out, is indeed rather complicated in some of its aspects. I would like to just cover the various provisions, if I may, and then respond to any questions that you may have. Section 1 deals with the Training and Building Fund. The Training and Building Fund is comprised of interest and penalty earnings on the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund and is for the purpose of capital improvements, various construction, operation of the Employment Security Division, and training of the workforce. Currently, some of the money is allocated to the Alaska Skill Center in Seward. And there's a technicality currently that requires that any unobligated balance of monies over $100,000 in this trust fund lapse back into the trust fund on the last day of the fiscal year. As you're well aware, on occasion there are times when certain appropriations do not get signed until near or after the end of the fiscal year, and as a consequence, the money is unavailable. This is a housekeeping measure to correct that accounting problem. It just holds the money an additional 30 days until the appropriation has an opportunity to be signed. Sections 2 and 3 are based on a desire by the federal government, the Congress, to reduce the insolvencies of a number of trust funds of the various states in regard to paying unemployment benefits. When a state lapses into a negative balance, the federal government has provisions for lending money to those states. And right at the moment, they have said, in effect, they're sick and tired of this, and they are tightening the screws down on a number of provisions so that the states will both obtain more money, collect more money in taxes for their trust fund, and in effect pay out less money. Now, Alaska, we enjoy a very healthy trust fund due to some actions which have been taken in the past, fine provision designed and passed by the legislature to keep the trust fund in healthy condition. In addition to that, we have a very responsible payment system, in my opinion. We do not pay claimants who are not eligible for their benefits, and as a consequence, we're in good shape. However, The feds have said, if you don't do some of these things, we're going to either withhold certain payments that you obtain, or we are not going to grant you certain forgiveness of taxes. As you're well aware, that's the way they often do it. Now, sections 2 and 3 are based on a measure entitled the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act, which the Congress passed, one of the provisions of which is to require that states have a maximum standard tax rate of 5.4%. And this is the employer tax rate. Any state which does not pass something in conformity with this requirement finds that employers in certain categories must pay the maximum tax of 5.4% instead of getting a vast percentage of it forgiven. As a consequence, we figured out what would happen under this act. We constructed a number of scenarios, and we selected the one that had the least effect on the employer community. It does not affect the employee community to a great degree because employees pay about 18% of the total amounts of money into the trust fund. But this Fiscal Responsibility Act required this 5.4%. So what we did is we said, okay, we're going to have this 5.4% rate. We will have it apply to 0.01% of the total tax-paying employers of the state in order to conform. Now, when I say conformity, the feds have a term that they say, you're going to do this, you're going to conform, or else we're going to erase these tax credits that you get, or we're going to withhold this money. And over in the Senate side, we said this is not a strictly conformity item. However, Senator Mulcahy kind of backed us to the wall and said, well, what's the effect if we do not pass this measure? And we said, it's going to cost certain employers of the state about $2 million in extra taxes that they're going to have to pay. And he said, well, I'd call that conformity, wouldn't you? So I really have to agree with him that if we do not pass this, certain employers currently who have low wages for their employees and have high rates will have to pay the difference between what they're paying now, which is namely $56,
not right, Sandy.
7% of 8% rather, 0.8% of $7,000, $56, and something like somewhat over $300.
If I could interrupt,
surely,
I think,
sir.
Note the presence of Neil Copeland and Representative Furness, I think, had a question on that point.
Yes, Jack, if you will,
Ringstead.
Would you explain the table at the end of page 2 and the greater part of page 3?
Yes, sir.
Explain what this table does.
When it comes to figure out each year how much tax we need to collect in order to keep the trust fund in solvent condition, we take all of the wages of the state and we divide them into 20 portions. In other words, 5% for each portion of the total amount of money that we're going to need to collect. And what we do, this results, of course, in 5% for each one of these classes. And we assign each one of these 5% increments a class number. So, of course, in the old days, we had 20 classes, 5%. That represented 100% of the amount of money, of the amount of payroll, which would equate to the amount of money that we need to collect. You'll see in column A, that's the rate class, 1 through 20. But aha, we see underlined a new rate class, 21. That's that new one that we designed to include the 0.01% of employers who would have to pay that very highest rate.
Who would have to pay that? Wait, you lost me here. Okay. I still don't understand what this is all about here. Let's take 12 here.
Okay, rate 12.
Yeah, explain across here, what does all this mean?
Okay, rate 12 includes those employers who had the payrolls which equated to between 55 and 60% of wages of the state.
Oh, okay, let me just make sure. ARCO pays an annual payroll of X number of dollars. You take that payroll and percentage to the total payrolls paid in the state?
Yes, sir.
I see. Okay. So this company or whatever, this class of company,
right,
paid between the 55 to 60% of the payrolls paid in the state of Alaska for them. Is that on an annual basis?
It's an annual basis, sir, but that's not a correct statement. That's a little misleading because what occurs is the rate assignment to each employer is designed to recover to the fund the approximate burden that employer creates by the number of persons that he lays off. And so this gets into another, this gets into the rate column on the left side, where it says rate class. And each one of these five percentile rate classes is assigned on the basis of the experience that the employer has had with laying people off, or otherwise decreasing the workforce. That's called the decline of the workforce. Okay. And the rate of decline is called the decline quotient, and it's figured by quarter, and it's called the quarterly decline quotient.
Okay.
And so this quarterly decline quotient measures, in effect, and has taken over the previous 3 years, measures, in effect, the number of workers that this employer has thrown out on the labor market who are eligible for benefits. And of course, seasonal employers then have a higher burden because they have more people out there drawing benefits. Employers with a very steady workforce have a rate class which is much higher, have a rate class which is lower, and therefore they pay less money. The reason that we have the accumulated ratable payroll, that column B, with each 5% increment, is so that we can find out where the employers fall within that particular category.
Right. So far, so good. So the experience factor, one that's very stable would be a smaller number. One,
exactly.
Two, three, one
exactly.
Higher layoff would be the higher numbers, 19, 20, 21, or whatever.
Yes, sir.
Now, what is column 3, C? How is that?
Column C is exactly what you have said, sir. In other words, if the employer has a steady workforce and has a fairly low rate class, numbers 1, 2, 3, or 4, they pay only 55% of the total tax that is required.
Of the 5.4%.
Yes. Well, actually, of the total necessary monies to be collected. In other words, the 5.4% is the maximum rate, and that is rate class 21 down here. That's what happens when you multiply 1.65 times the average tax. The average tax now each year, right now the average tax is around 3.2 is the average tax. And of course the average tax changes annually depending on how much money is needed to replenish the trust fund.
One other question there.
Surely.
This person 21, rate 21, would pay the maximum 5.4%.
Yes, sir.
The others are adjusted down based upon the percentage factor.
Exactly, exactly.
The experience factor.
Yes, sir, the experience, in other words, how many people they've laid off.
I see.
And how, in other words, how stable their particular workforce is.
Construction, temporary, construction, I suppose.
Construction, seafood,
seasonal.
Processors.
I see. So a small real estate office then with very low turnover could be a rate 1,
very
2, or 3.
Rate.
Exactly.
With a factor of 50, 40 to maybe 60 or whatever.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right.
So they would pay a far lesser rate.
Okay, so how does a 5.4 fit into this?
We don't need the 5.4% to collect from our employers, but the Fed said you got to have it. So we said we're going to take a very tiny percentage of the total employer community and assign them this 21st rate, this 100th of 1%. And we figured out what it would happen if we would have applied that, if this would have been in effect.
So the guy that's paying 1.65% of the average tax
right.
will pay 5.4%.
Yes, sir.
What, 5.4% is the max recharge.
Yes, sir. That is on the payroll base of $20,000, $20,400.
Okay. What are we using as the maximum now?
The maximum right now is about.
But it's 3.1.
4.1%.
4.1. So currently, we go up to 1.6
right.
of the 4.1.
Of the average tax, which is around 3, which makes about
4.1. Yeah. Okay, so 1.6 is equivalent to 4.1. The 1.65 will be equivalent to 5.4. And we're using this new class of the 100 to fit that category. Any idea how many? And what groups
yes, sir.
That who are we really addressing?
Exactly. We know if this rate would have been in effect for 1984, no employers would have fit into the category. It was such a small number, and they were lumped in the same experience rating as a number of employers in rate class 20. And since the law currently says we cannot discriminate against any particular employer, no matter how many of the employers would we select out to give the higher rate, we can't do that, so we gave them the lower rate. Had it been in effect in 1983, there would have been 163 employers affected for a total additional tax of $2,800 or $17 per employer. And this would have affected, well, not a big effect, as you have pointed out, sir, with your chuckle.
Who we looked at?
Generally speaking, these would be employers with highly seasonal workforces and with fairly high employer rates.
Could be construction companies.
Could be small construction companies, other seasonal type operations, fish processors. We felt would fall in this category. We have a listing of the various types, and it cuts across quite a few different kinds of industrial lines.
Go ahead, though, and then I'll.
You might point out and what the state would, if we don't adopt these, what the state would lose in dollars and what it would cost.
This one, sir, would result in a loss of
from the federal government.
From the federal government of $2 million in employer taxes. This is not one of the biggies, but this is still, well, forgive me, $2 million is a biggie. But these employers that I mentioned would have to pay an additional $2 million in tax, not the 163. Those are just the ones that are affected by this measure. But probably close to, I think we figured out a near, quite a bit over 1,000 employers would be affected for close to $2 million.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, the Section 2 is a new section. You state here the standard rate of contributions with respect to employment is 5.4% of wages paid. Okay, fine. Presently, what is it right now? Is it under, is it in statute somewhere else? 4.1, did you say?
Let me see. Do we, is a standard rate we enunciate as 4.2?
We don't have one.
We don't have one. Standard rate.
But now you're required by federal law to be,
yes, sir,
to put this. I mean, there's a reason for putting in the statutes, isn't it?
Yes,
are you
sir.
Required that it has to be in a bill form and pass the legislature?
Yes, sir. Every October, the federal Department of Labor reviews all of our statutes to see if we're in conformity, and if we're not, then we start paying fearsome penalties, which I'll outline in shortly.
Okay. Now, if you can assure, and I want to make sure that we get this for the record, that the changes that are in Section 2 and Section 3, how is that going to change the average tax to every employer in the state of Alaska on an average? Is it possible that you figured that in all your averages?
No, sir. The effect will be very little except for those employers who are delinquent or adjudged to be fraudulent, and those employers will be paying the maximum tax rate as they are now. Currently, they're paying the 4.2%. Under this scenario, those employers who are delinquent will be required to pay the 5.4%. There are currently no employers who have been under fraud indictment.
How many employees are necessary on the minimum where they would be required to pay the unemployment compensation?
I believe it's 10.
The number of employees for an employer to be liable is 3.
Forgive me, any time an employee is hired by an employer.
Yeah.
Thank
all
you.
Employees.
All employees, but okay. Well, I know that if you had, like, let's say, an income piece of property and you hired somebody that could do some work on your income piece of property, that might be a small kind of operation where maybe you'd have somebody, one or two people. I thought there might be some kind of a minimum where you had to have a corporation or a partnership or something.
I don't think so.
No, sir. Oftentimes when persons have occasional or casual jobs done like that, it's done on sort of a contractual
mm-hmm.
basis, like mowing the lawn.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
People will bring his own
somebody
lawnmower.
Painting a fence or something like that, or just considered, I think, most construction firms or business firms have that type of thing. They don't normally put them on the normal payroll. It's just a casual labor situation. I think that maybe somewhere what the limits of that is what the tax people are, but generally just casual labor.
Yeah. I have no more questions. I just, as we go along, I may have questions, but I would appreciate moving along with it.
So we designed this particular provision to be in conformity, even though we do not need the extra money. And the effect we feel is going to be relatively small on a relatively low number of employers to pay that extra money. As we pointed out, an ATD3 would have been $17.
I'll ask a question on this, Mr. Chairman. Jack, to your knowledge, this bill appears to have been introduced by 1484. Has there been any public hearings on this?
No, that's the draft.
No, this is the draft.
That's the draft.
When was it introduced?
It was over in the Senate. It went through the Senate.
Yes, sir. There were hearings on the Senate side.
May the 3rd, is the committee substitute.
Well, maybe I can just ask anybody that knows. Don, do you know
what the bill says?
Do you know the public hearing?
Yes, there were hearings, sir, over.
Oh, yes. I've talked
on the Senate side.
I have talked with Sackett and Fergie both. They were both aware of this on the Senate side of the hearing process, and I talked to them yesterday about as we get on down into the bill, an amendment that this committee made.
But they did hold hold teleconference hearing or just hearings or committee hearings?
There were regular hearings, sir. Yes.
Were there teleconference hearings also?
No, there were not.
Okay.
This is 3784.
All right. Do we, you know, if there has been any change? I guess what I'm trying to piece as we go through.
Changes?
Yeah, well, not the changes, but the certain organized groups are going to be okay, but what about the employer groups? And what input have they had in this so far? That's what I guess I'm trying to assess here as we go through.
The employer groups, to a degree, were represented by the Employment Security Advisory Council. And the Employment Security Advisory Council, who has some employers on it, had gone over all the provisions of the bill and had recommended the bill. And with one exception, there was not totality in regard to the first provision for the wage or the payment schedule or the benefit schedule. They felt that 198, some of them felt it was supportable, some of them felt that was a little bit too much. But
what about the Chamber
amended.
Of Commerce group, for example?
I have talked with George Cruz, and he doesn't have any problems with the current piece of legislation.
We need to cover that, sir.
Continue.
Yes, sir. There was quite a bit of apprehension evidenced by others in regard to this original payment schedule, but I'll outline that as we go through it.
I want to just have that on the table as we go through it.
Yes, sir. Because there were questions which were mounted on the Senate side in regard to this 5.48 and what effect it would have on employers. And that's why we did some research in regard to digging out the 163 the year before. This year, none. Next year, it could be a number, but it wouldn't be a very large number. We also felt that the 5.48 would inspire quicker payments by those persons who were delinquent in order to avoid that higher rate. Hopefully that will help our fund become solvent and will help delinquent employers to pay more quickly.
Representative Yearley.
Yes, I'm going to ask questions as we go along here, and maybe we can kind of keep things moving along. Page 3, where the underlined amount on line 27, what is meant there when you add the amount of interest earned on the trust fund balance? How does that change the trust fund balance?
In the old days, when we figured the amount of money in the trust fund, which was part of the formula, we included the interest in the total amount. Certain employer interests pointed out to us that we didn't really need to do that, and it was resulting in the trust fund increasing at unnecessary rates. In other words, the trust fund is getting larger and larger, and that one of the reasons was we were enjoying a very good return of interest on the fund balance, which is currently about $148 million. And when we originally designed the formula, we didn't realize we were going to get that much interest from it. And so we decided, in order to cool down the collections, to reduce the collections, and to keep the trust fund in a more controllable state, that we would reduce, and this was introduced after the bill was first proposed, we would reduce the amount of interest earned on the trust fund balance before computing the rates, which would result in lower rates. This was actually in response to a request from Representative Hayes to the Legislative Research Agency asking how the trust fund could be better better control. This is one of the two measures to do that. And as a consequence, David Teal from the research agency came to us with two possibilities, one of which was this excluding the amount of interest from the calculation, which in effect reduces the employer and employee contribution rates.
Across the board.
Yes, sir.
Now, the money that's in the trust fund, is that, are you required to invest that money, or does it sit there, or is it in a checking account?
It is invested, sir.
It is invested
to obtain the maximum return.
And who determines that? Department of Labor?
Federal Department of Labor. They are actually the guardians of the trust fund. And I'm not sure who does that within the U.S. Department, but it's apparently a very effective cadre of investors because we have enjoyed a very good return.
But of course, employers are the employers throughout the state. What I'm saying is this trust fund just for the state of Alaska only?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So does it stay in Alaska, or is it in Alaskan banks or Alaska investments, or is it in some kind of a federal situation?
That I don't know, sir.
It goes to the federal treasury.
Well, that answers my question, I guess.
So,
Representative Ringstaff?
As we go along the bill, we get into changing the benefits package also.
Yes, sir.
So apparently we're increasing the amount the employers have to pay for that one category of the highest risk people. And then we're increasing the amounts that the unemployment checks.
Yes, sir.
Are these being changed on a percentage basis, or we just changed the top category?
No, sir.
Apparently, we went up from
156
to $188 for the top category, top amount.
This has a lot of
what? How was this?
Why did we do that? How did we figure that out?
Yeah, how did we get the change?
For a number of years, the federal government, sir, suggested that the insurance policy be a function of replacing 50% wages for about between 70% and 80% of the workforce. This was a suggested guideline. This is not mandatory or conformity item. In 1980, the state legislature seized on the principle that the plan should provide 50% wage replacements for 2/3 of the workforce. The selection of those lowered figures are, if you will, a kind of a deductible portion, if you care to think of it like that. But the wage schedule then was designed so that 50% of the workforce would receive about 67% wage. 67% of the workforce would receive 50% wage replacement. In 1980, that was adopted. In 1982, we came back with a package which would maintain that ratio, and it did not reach that point. There was a $6 increase granted from $150 to $156. We designed, once again for this year, a payment schedule which would result in that same ratio. However, it was felt to be too great by a number of persons, including employer groups, for Representative Furness's information.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a counterproposal, and this was hammered out in the Senate Finance Committee, came up with another wage schedule. Instead of $198 maximum, $188. And this results in about a 50% wage replacement for approximately 60 to 61% of the workforce. And that is the current schedule you see before you, which is listed on pages 7 and 8.
So what we're saying is that in these wage categories, 61% of the people, this is 50% of their wage.
Of the total, yes, sir.
So if I'm making $18,000, 61% of the people making that wage will be making double that amount.
No, sir. What it means is that if you examine the schedule closely, you'll see that it's weighted somewhat toward the benefit of the lower wage earners. And so as a consequence, the persons near the top end of the scale receive less of a percentage of wage replacement than do those at the bottom.
What? Okay.
The 50% wage replacement is only an average.
Okay. 50% of what? Gross wages or net wages or?
50% of the gross, wage.
So we're aiming at least in your, on the average here, providing somebody half of their gross wages. If you figure you're going to lose 25% to 33% in taxes and miscellaneous, what have you, by giving them 50% of the gross, they're only losing about 20% of their wages if they're not working.
Depending on their wage category. I should point out here that the average weekly wage of the Alaskan worker is currently about $540. That's the average. That's the average wage, because a lot of those people in the workforce are making far more than the $19,750. In fact, I believe about 40% of the workforce makes more than that amount.
So we're only taking the 50% on the lower. Once you get over the $20,000,
right,
your
you can't get any more.
Your ratios get all skewed. Your
yes, sir.
50% isn't accurate.
Correct.
So you've averaged your 50% over the 20,000 and down.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, could I just comment on that? So what you're saying is that anything that's over the $20,000 level, someone receives unemployment insurance then or compensation later on, they're going to, they can only get paid 50% of the highest category that you have.
That's right. Well, they can get the, all they can receive is what the maximum is here, namely $188, which is generally far less than their average wage.
Even if they're making $100,000 a year.
Exactly. It has been felt that it's kind of a maintenance measure, and of course the average person who is making $540 a week is going to find that, as Representative Ringstedt points out, is going to find about 30 to 35% taxes and other benefits removed, and as a consequence they're still getting a fairly decent amount.
Representative Ringstedt.
Mr. Chairman, has there been any consideration of putting a top dollar amount as to what you can earn and still be able to collect unemployment? Like Representative Ewing said, for example, if I go out and make $100,000 a year, can I collect unemployment for the other 6 months? So can anybody consider
I don't that? Recall anything on that nature.
It would be out of conformity with federal
you
law.
You can't. I don't think that.
We could not impose that.
So according to the federal law, then, you cannot put a cap on how much I can earn.
That's right.
Unself-insured. In other words, if you're self-employed, you don't fall under any of these categories if you're self-employed. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
And so the only situation you have is if you work for a corporation or a person specifically, and you are on a specific payroll, and
right.
You're making
$150,000. There's an employee-employer relationship, and you are not an officer of the corporation,
right,
with at least 25% stock in the corporation, which we'll cover in another measure here. Thank you, sir. And please interrupt me at any time if anything is not clear. Section 4 was also in response to the Speaker of the House's inquiry in regard to how can we keep the trust fund from growing too large. And he caused to be created a paper by David Teal, who was one of the architects of the original schedule of payments. And what had happened was, in order to make sure that the trust fund remains solvent, I think I discussed section 4 already.
Yes.
In regard to the reduction of, or the elimination of the interest earnings, but section 5 goes hand in hand with that. We had a provision to increase the tax if the trust fund fell down below certain levels, in other words below about 3% or 3.2% of the total wages of the state. Total wages of the state right now are in the neighborhood of $5 billion. And we're getting to be kind of big time, gentlemen, because our gross state product is almost $20 billion. Total wages of workers is about $5 billion. And so at that level, about $150 million we feel is proper for a trust fund balance. That will pay wages, that will pay benefits, if there's no increase in number of claimants for about a year and 5 months with no income to the fund. We feel that that kind of condition would seldom be reached. However, if there were something catastrophic where the trust fund were exhausted, there would be other measures that could be taken. But at any rate, the speaker and the research agency came with a fund adjustment. Instead of just adding to the tax when the fund was low, now when the fund reaches 3.3% of gross wages, there's a credit to the employer taxes. As you can see on the beginning of page 5, if the trust fund reaches 3.6% or above of the total wages of the state, for example, employers receive a 4/10 reduction in their tax rate. In other words, 40% reduction of whatever the percentage is, mm-hmm. and so forth. It will float then, the trust fund will float between about 3 and 3.3% of the total wages of the state. In other words, right now, somewhere around $150 million. And there's no adjustment for that figure. If the trust fund falls below that, then there's a slight addition added to the tax. If it goes above it, the taxes are reduced. We feel that that was a good stabilizing influence on the trust fund, and we agreed with the speaker's desires in this regard. And as a matter of fact, we were going to propose it next year, or at least our advisory committee was looking at something like that to keep the trust fund from growing unnecessarily. That's what Section 5 and also 4 are about. We don't want the trust fund to get too big because it's a burden on the employers and the employees to pay extra taxes into it. Section 6, we've already touched upon, is the increase in the weekly benefit amount. And there has been some talk at one time of increasing the base period wage requirement to something greater than $1,000, since persons earning $1,000 have a very small attachment to the labor market. But they, on the other hand, represent a rather small percentage of the labor market, and so the fiscal impact on the fund is not great. Those persons between earning between $1,000 and $1,500, I believe, are something only like 4% of the total workers, a rather small percent. So this new payment schedule is designed to keep pace with inflation and keep pace with the wage replacement principle.
Representative Rink, that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said a relatively small percent of the total labor market. What percent are they of the claimants?
That's exactly the figure I have here, sir, and I have it with relative speaking.
You said the people that are making $1,000, $1,500 a month are a small percent of the labor market. The question is, what percent are they of the claimants?
That's what I meant, sir. And the percentage of the claimants who are making $1,500 or less, excuse me, it's even smaller than I indicated. It's 1.3% of the claimants are at or below that earning level.
1.3%?
Yes, 1.36%.
So maybe we get $42 a week.
Right. $42 or less a week.
Since you have it, can you tell us what is the, perhaps the highest percentage
sure.
level for a claimant?
The claimants currently who are, forgive my nearsightedness, these figures are a little small, $19,750, that represents claimants who are at or below that wage level are 65.78% of that workforce. So there are still about 35% of the workers who are making more than $19,750. 65.48. So this wage schedule now is going to cost more money, obviously. You have the fiscal note on already. However, because of the trust fund balance health and the fact that the investments made have been quite favorable, and we have been responsible, in my opinion, in the payment of benefits. We have paid every claimant, our principal is to pay every claimant who has benefits legally entitled. Nevertheless, we are going to be able to reduce employer and employee taxes over the next 3 years, and perhaps longer, excuse me. Now the taxes collected would have gone down even further. The tax rates and the amount of tax collected would have gone down even further had we not increased benefits. But we felt it was necessary in order to provide a true insurance policy to the workers of this state to increase the benefit package at this time and to raise the maximum.
Maximum, Mr. Chairman, the maximum presently is how much on the highest amount?
$156 a week.
Okay, that's right.
Plus the dependency allowance.
That goes to 180.
Yes, sir. Section 7 of the bill, both Section 7 and 8, change the dependent allowance. They don't change the requirements, but under the current method, if both parents are working, only one parent can claim up to three dependents, a maximum of three dependent children. Excuse me, when I say dependents, I should say dependent children because spouses are not included. Dependent children. This measure would allow, in case both parents were out of work and there were more than three children in the family, would allow both parents or each parent to claim up to a maximum of three dependent children, not the same children, of course. In addition to that, and those are where children, of course, are jointly supported because both persons had to have income in order to be eligible for the benefits in the first place. So that means the children have been jointly supported. And under the principles of a true insurance policy, for example, if a man and wife are both insured for a particular accident and they have the accident, both of them get paid. Any kind of disability accident, an automobile accident. And so we felt this was much fairer to the insurance premium payers, who are the employee and the employers of the people. In addition to that, the current system doesn't allow the addition of any dependents through the year, the dependent children, unless there are certain extraordinary circumstances. But now there is a provision: when the one person's benefit year ends, the other person can pick up those children under their benefit year. Before the second person's benefit year would have to end also for the children to be added. So there could be a period in there where a family with two children and both persons unemployed could not be eligible for drawing the dependents allowance. We feel this is fairer, and the total fiscal impact is relatively small. In addition to that, at one point it has been said, is the dependent children allowance fair at all? Isn't it unconstitutional? Well, that could be argued. However, when we looked at it, we found that the vast majority of the dependency allowance stays within the state, is paid to Alaskan claimants. And claimants that come from Oklahoma and Texas and the other places that we sometimes shudder to think about where our money is going. We find that very little of the dependency allowance goes to those claimants from out of state. Traditionally, they have very few children or they don't claim their dependence allowance. And the vast majority of the dependence allowance which is paid stays within the state of Alaska. And so that's one of the rationales which the legislature has used in the past to maintain the dependency allowance. Section 9, I guess, relates also to Section 11. It's kind of the state giveth and the feds taketh away. One of the conformity items which is outlined in Section 11 requires that we deny benefits to any school employees between terms. In other words, any kind of vacation period that they might have. Now, about 6 years ago, a payment system was instituted to allow the payment of benefits to all school employees between terms of school, any educational institution employees. The feds rethought that and came down and required that teachers be eliminated from drawing. Teachers, administrators, and research workers in the educational system be denied benefits, whereas all other workers, seasonal workers in this industry, were allowed benefits. Now the feds have come down and said, once again, this is one of these things to keep the trust funds more solvent. They have said, now you're going to start denying benefits to school employees. As Chairman Cowdery has said, that includes bus drivers, food service workers, clerical, teachers' aides, custodians, janitorial people, and maintenance workers. These personnel have been drawing benefits if they are in the labor market, if they're sincerely looking for work and they're available for work. It doesn't count for those people who go on vacation or who are not really seriously in the labor market. However, the Employment Security Advisory Council, as did the chair of this committee and a number of other people, evinced anxiety that this was the first assault by the federal government on seasonal workers, and then the next step could very well be construction workers, fish processing workers, loggers,
and other kinds of seasonal workers, and that the next thing the feds would do is to try to eliminate benefits for them. So this particular measure was drafted as an addition to the original measure in order to allow an interim benefits program to pay benefits to employees of educational institutions that we had to knock out under Section 11. Under Section 11, we had to take it away. And Section 9 restores it with a special state program. Now, some have said this could possibly be viewed as an interim measure, as a temporary provision in order to allow benefits until such time as these benefits could be restored to these categories of workers through collective bargaining or through some other means. So that may be one way of viewing this.
I'd like to point out to the committee there's something like 1,400 people in the state that we're talking about that fit in this category.
Question along that line, Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
Do you know what the cost is going to be?
Yes, sir. There's a fiscal note to that. There's approximately $1.8 million in benefits and about $200,000 in administrative costs in order to pay that.
If I could, just for information to the committee, in the past, or as it stood now, these 1,400 people are denied unemployment if they... Well, it appeared to me that if it's retroactive, they still qualify. There's some qualifications, in other words, so that's what the reason that I, and I have, we have breakdowns here of what districts, I don't know if everybody's got this handwritten thing in there.
What is it? No, what is it?
No, that's not important.
Okay, this is the various benefits paid to claimants for the quarters that we're to
Mr. Chairman, if I may pursue just a minute, if we could divert to the fiscal note. A note that, let's see, there's one here. What is this one? Agency affected all unemployment insurance. Okay. Personal services, $169,000 the first year. And let's see, personal services, claims and grants look like $600,000 for this year, $2 million next year, and $2.1 million extended out. Is that, am I reading that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'd like to note the President's representative.
Well, I got to you, didn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Just another pretty face.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If you could continue that.
In the design of this program, which is under Section 9, to restore these benefits, we have run this by our federal counterparts to see if everything that we propose in this section is in conformity or will be acceptable to them as far as the design of the state program, and they said yes, everything is okay except for the last sentence in Section D. That's under 23.20.354 state interim benefits, appearing on page 10 of the draft legislation.
Yeah, I think it's
and
bracketed.
That it's bracketed, and it says the amount of state interim benefits paid shall be deducted from retroactive benefits payable under the current statute, and that's what the chair referred to when he said that if a person now is working for a school district and they have a reasonable assurance that they're going back to work at the end of the year, they can file for benefits, and if it turns out they do go back to work, then they're not eligible. But if it turns out the employer-employee relationship is severed at the end of the summer or the end of the vacation period, then they are allowed retroactive benefits. And we wanted to design the state program to prevent them from drawing their retroactive benefits plus the state benefits, and the Fed said we can't do that. So that particular measure will have to be stricken from that section.
Well, it's heavy in favor of the employee, so.
Yes. Indeed.
We don't totally lose over that much.
In addition, this...
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. One question.
Not at all.
I was reading through here. I'm trying to read a little ahead of you. I would assume that during that interim period that the person received the same amount that they would have received under we have a schedule here.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
What schedule is this?
Well, the one appearing on page 8.
I think it addresses that, doesn't it?
Yes, indeed it does.
Yeah.
Yes, sir, 7 and 8.
Section C.
Right.
Section 6, I mean. Right, all right. That was my question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir. It's designed, in order to expedite it, in case it were going to be implemented this summer, of course, we need to get out by approximately May 22nd, in fact, to start taking claims of the persons who are going to be affected by this denial of benefits. And we would need to design a relatively fast program to get out there and make sure that everyone had an opportunity to claim who was interested in looking for work and available for work and able to work.
Do you have any questions on that? If you continue, please.
Yes, sir. Section 10 is a small measure which adds severance and termination pay to the list of income which is deducted from UI benefits. It is, under the provision as it is now, wages in lieu of dismissal notice and payments for accrued vacation, sick, and so forth are deducted dollar for dollar, but this adds severance and termination pay because that is really income which has been earned as a condition of employment. It's a kind of a wage replacement payment, and so that would also be deducted.
Hmm.
Anybody have any
questions? I have
questions
a question about that.
Representative Yuna?
Okay.
Did you have one, Representative?
No, earlier I thought that your solution to the problem is probably the best one I can come up with.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now.
Representative Yuna?
I have another meeting.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Are you saying that they would deduct severance? In other words, if someone got a severance payment check or a termination payment, let's say for 4 weeks for severance pay, that they would take out deductions for that now under this provision?
Yes, sir. Correct. This under this new provision.
Even though that person never worked. I mean, in other words, even this is in the case of what I understand severance pay would be if you terminate an employee and for whatever reason maybe they're not doing a good job or maybe there's some kind of a problem or because they have to lay them off, they give them severance pay and it might be 2 weeks of free pay in addition to whatever they get for their vacation pay and everything else. So you're saying that previously they did not deduct for that?
That's correct, sir. Right.
However, that person never actually worked. It is just a credit that has been given to from the employer to the employee for service rendered, I mean, for good behavior, whatever, for
the
loyalty or whatever.
Your point is a good one, sir, but it's felt that these are wage replacement type payments. In other words, usually when a person gets termination or severance pay, they're given 2 weeks,
right,
2 weeks notice, or sometimes it's longer. In the case of federal employees, they earn severance pay based on their service. And if, for example, an employer has to lay someone off because they don't have enough work or they don't have enough wages, they pay the employee. And it is felt that this is wage replacement and therefore should be deducted from the unemployment benefit payment.
Somewhat related to that, I'd like to point out to say many of the union retirement programs that they have, if you choose, you could be worked right up and choose to retire September 1, you're not entitled, if you go into retirement, not entitled to unemployment benefits. So, and that's kind of related, I think.
Yes, sir, it is.
Can we go on there, Mr. Chairman? Then also, it says, or payment for vacation. Now, in the case of some of the state employees that work for the state of Alaska, I mean, they get vacation pay that they might build up for like 4 or 5 months.
Right.
They may, I know people who have built up payment for vacation for, let's say, 10 years, and then they take 6 months off, and that's just accrued vacation pay.
Correct.
They have never actually worked that. I mean, they have not physically worked 6 months. That is just a benefit, a fringe. And I would object to putting that in there unless there was some kind of a federal requirement.
Is this a federal requirement?
No, it is not.
A state's idea of how did this come about?
Well, it's to keep the trust fund in good condition because the person who is drawing vacation pay is not felt to be unemployed, and that is the reason. Is that how I understand you, sir? You feel that unemployment benefits should be paid to a person on vacation?
Well, I'm saying that. Let me give an example. Like an estate employee receives so many hours every month, which is leave time.
Correct.
And what you're saying here is that they're going to take out a deduction for their leave time. that leave time, they never actually worked. I mean, that's just an accredited benefit that has been attributed to them for the time that they have become been an employee. Let's say an employee has been an employee of the state of Alaska for 10 years, and then they decide that they will take their leave time. They will be therefore, from what I understand this to be, they would actually be, that would be deducted out of that complete check if it was for a 4-month period.
If they take it in a lump sum payment, correct me on this, Sandy, if they take it in a lump sum payment, then it's only deducted in that week in which it's received.
Only 1 week then.
That's right.
So that's
correct.
I don't have a problem.
Yes. And then if they're on vacation, however, then they do not receive it. For example,
right.
If...
Well, I'm just saying that some of these people take leave, they may take it for 3 or 4 months because they've built it up over
right.
a period of years.
Yeah.
If it's only for 1 week, I don't...
Yes, sir, if they receive lump sum. And sometimes it's some lump.
Right.
Before the taxes on it. Section 11 is the... section I referred to before, which is the federal conformity item. Now, there are several items in here which are true conformity items, and these are the ones where they have the big hammer. And these particular elements, if they are not complied with, cost the state employers, employees, and the state administrative program $112 million annually, comprised of about $80 million in employer tax forgiveness, and a certain amount of reimbursable type elements, plus the administrative costs of running the unemployment insurance and the job service programs. The grand total is about $112 million. So they've got a pretty big hammer there in order to encourage our compliance with their desires.
$112 million, you say?
Yes, sir. This particular item, as I said, was one of the measures designed to increase the health of the trust funds of the individual states. We don't need it. We're in good shape without this, but we have to implement it, and that is why the interim measure was designed. Section 12 has to do with the Expended Employment Compensation Act. It required an indefinite disqualification of an extended benefit claimant who did not actively engage in seeking work. The feds recently relaxed that a little bit, curiously enough. And they said that if a person is hospitalized or on jury duty, that they could still draw benefits. Now, even though they're not available for work, we felt that this was a good measure to implement, because if a person is in a claimant status, that means that the reason that they are being able to claim is not because they're on jury duty or because they've been hospitalized, but for some other reason that caused them to leave work prior to that. If they left work because of being unable to work, then they wouldn't be eligible to draw benefits. And this is an optional measure which will not cost a very great deal of money.
Okay, down on line 22, page 12, so what we're saying is that presently, let's say someone under the present law, if someone is hospitalized for 4 or 5 months and they can no longer work, are they presently paid unemployment insurance?
If they're hospitalized during a week in which compensation benefits are payable, and until such time as they are offered a suitable job, they are eligible for benefits. The rationale behind that is because then the reason that they're unemployed is not because they're hospitalized or because they're ill or otherwise disabled, but because of something that occurred beforehand which has already been cleared up, a layoff, a quit for good cause, or some other reason.
Okay. So how does it change present law by number B here?
It allows payments for jury duty and for hospitalization for treatment for emergency or life-threatening conditions. And that would occur even if the person were not in claimant status.
I understand.
Under that provision.
He's the brains of the outfit.
Then does, right now, if someone quits a job, is there any penalty?
Oh, yes. If they quit without good cause,
yes.
they are denied benefits for a waiting week period plus 6 weeks. And their total benefit amount is reduced by 3 weeks' payments. And the same thing goes if they take action which is tantamount to in opposition to the employer's interests. If they are fired for good cause, the same penalty applies. This provision.
Well, let me just take a situation. Let's say somebody is they get in an auto accident and they cannot work because they're in some kind of an accident. Would they be able to claim unemployment
if they're not available for work? Is that what you're
well,
saying?
Obviously they aren't available for work because they're in an emergency situation. Could that be paid immediately then? Is that what this is going to allow, or are they going to have to wait 6 weeks?
No, sir. They would be eligible immediately or at the end of the
whereas
week.
Presently that is not the case.
That's correct. If they had to leave work because of hospitalization or emergency, then they would not be eligible. But under this provision, they would be.
There's sort of a loophole there, I could see. In that, you know, someone could say, well, they're hospitalized for treatment, but it doesn't, that's all it says, hospitalized for treatment of an emergency. Well, it depends on what you categorize as an emergency.
I doubt that there would be too much abuse of people going up and getting hurt.
I don't know.
Well, I don't know. The people could be hospitalized for weeks and weeks and they could call it an emergency.
So we do require medical certification, sir, of anything that affects this. We require a physician's statement, in fact, signed by the physician. We have special forms that we use.
Good.
Thank you. Section 13 addresses a loophole which came to light just this last year, in which persons who were working primarily on the slope had 4 or 5 and sometimes 6 weeks off or so. And they came down and they said, hey, I'm unemployed, let's file for benefits. And so they filed for benefits, and we denied them initially, and they went to a commissioner's appeal, and upon looking at it and reading the law very carefully, the commissioner reversed the decision and allowed them benefits, because the way the current law is written, these persons technically are allowed benefits. And this is designed to close up that loophole, because we felt that they're attachment to the labor market is still intact. They're still part of their employer-employee relationship still exists. They're coming down. They have made large wages with the understanding that they would be unemployed during these short R&R periods. And so what we are doing here is saying that if a person is working an average of at least 40 hours a week, because generally speaking, sometimes they work very, very long hours when they're up on the slope or in some of these remote camp locations. We felt that it was fair that they be considered to be employed during their periods of R&R, and that they were not eligible for benefits. Section 14 is once again a conformity issue, and it includes corporate officers who control at least 25% of the corporate stock. Excludes them from UI coverage. Formerly, they had a waiver that they could sign. The federal government said you can't waive this. We fought them back and forth on this for about 6 or 8 months, and they finally said, no, I'm sorry, but our final decision is that you must exclude from coverage certain of those corporate officers who control at least 25% of corporate stock.
Yeah, like I was reading this, and it doesn't make that clear, but I understand. I've read the sectional analysis and the statement here. My question goes to offices of non-profit corporation who serve in an exec capacity. Do they receive the same waiver?
Well, non-profit corporations wouldn't have stock, I don't believe, sir.
No, that's why you can't tie it in. But yeah, as you know, within the state of Alaska, the state normally does not contract with a profit group. It contracts with non-profit groups.
Oh, right.
But you have persons who serve in a president or a chairman capacity in that setting who deserve to probably have that same type of waiver.
That's a very good question, sir. I don't know if we've had any problems with that, have we?
No, quite a few of the nonprofits are reimbursable.
By that he means that when benefits are paid to those individuals, the corporation reimburses the trust fund for those wage payments. Most municipalities, the state employees and federal employees, and quite a few nonprofit corporations are under this plan, whereby they do not pay a tax into the fund, but rather their payments
upon employment compensation are reimbursed to the fund. They pay, they're paid out of the fund and then collected back from the employers. So those kinds of nonprofit corporation employees would indeed, well, they would all be covered in that scenario.
Mr. Chairman, I want to pursue that up next year.
Surely.
Okay, so you're saying, thank you, you're saying that if an executive officer of a corporation owns more than 25%, they would be disallowed unemployment compensation?
Yes, sir.
Well, that's a positive thing.
Oh, I think it's a positive thing. Now, right. Presently, they could, if they had 50% of the corporation, they could claim unemployment compensation. First, I don't know.
No, they doesn't have any legal relationship.
Is that correct?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand the question.
Okay.
Sir.
If the, let's say they own more than, presently, if they own more than 25% of the stock of a corporation and they're executive officer of that corporation, can they claim unemployment compensation?
Yes, if they have elected to do so and have not waived their benefit right. Is that correct?
Let's say they want to take a 6-month vacation in Hawaii and let someone else run the corporation.
Doesn't make
they have to be available for work though, sir, and actively seeking work.
Okay.
And we check up on them.
Yeah.
Okay. As I understand, the key to this section, a person who owns less than 25% of the stock does not enjoy the benefit of this section. And that's
they very, yes, they are still covered. Yeah. Still covered by compensation. Okay. So.
Very interesting. It's unusual circumstances that would have
raised across, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, indeed, sir.
Yes, the section. Or do you?
I must say, sir, that it is. A little confusing. I've only been in this job about 7 months, and I'm still learning. And I forgive me for my hesitation on some of these elements.
This is fantastic. Yeah. We're going to drop that one section.
Page 10, line
page
20.
Page 10, line 20. The sentence that's in the bracketed. We're going to drop that out. And,
One other question.
Yeah.
I note that I believe the bill was introduced. Looks like May 3rd or whatever. Mm-hmm. How long has the department been working on this?
For about a year.
Okay.
Based on we have an Employment Security Advisory Council, which is comprised of individuals from various sectors, and they come to us with recommendations, and we act on them and draft legislation. We had the legislation done about. Was ready to go by, I think, in January, but it didn't get introduced because originally it was going to be introduced by the administration, and that didn't occur, and it was introduced finally in the Senate.
Okay, I'm more interested, I should have clarified it, interested in the section covering those educational employees. How long have you been aware of that, and when was that put into the bill?
It was just now put into the bill, in this committee.
Oh, it was? Okay.
The interim benefits was, sir, yes.
Okay, right. That's what I was interested in. It was brought to my attention a couple of weeks ago by one of the labor officials.
Actually,
that was a problem.
Yes, the denial of benefits has been known for about a year that we were going to have to do something like that.
Okay.
That's been known for about a year that we were going to have to conform to the federal legislation.
Right. I think that perhaps I talked to you a little bit on the floor or something, but I've had this about a week or 10 days, I think, trying to come up with a solution.
Yeah. Now let's see, this is a Senate bill, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
For the Senate, now you added in the interim benefit?
Yes, but I talked with the Senate about that.
They still have to concur with that section of the bill, then?
Yes.
Is there foreseen any problems on the Senate side?
I don't. I had talked to Ms. Sackett and Fergie both yesterday.
Right. So the $600,000 or right at... about 800,000.
And Adams, this will have to go to the House Finance.
Hold it prepared there. All right.
Any other questions, Jack?
Glad you guys have done this.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
We have one other witness from the District Council of Labor that you'd just like to.
I'll be real short.
Your name for the record.
My name is Don Rouleau. I'm with the District Council of Labor, and I'm also speaking on behalf of State Federation of Labor. Just want to go on record as we support this bill. And want to thank the committee chairman and his staff, Department of Labor, for taking care of those district employees that were thrown out in the cold by the feds. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. It's my intention to correct this one section of, or delete bracket that one and then move this bill out.
Do a motion?
I think it's very, yes, I think it's very important to, that we get this on to, and on the governor's desk this year.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I would move that we adopt the committee substitute for, committee substitute for Senate Bill 525, Labor and Commerce, dated 5/14/84.
Yeah.
Ask unanimous consent.
Any objections? So be it.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we pass from committee the House Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 525, Labor and Commerce, and the several accompanying fiscal notes.
Yes, with the deleted section on page 10.
Right.
The paragraph on line 20 here through 26.
That's good.
Hearing no objections, so be it. Okay. The next bill we'll deal with is Senate Bill 517, relating to workman's compensation. Senate Bill 517 is designed to solve, help solve the problems of inconsistency of time periods which now exist in the Workman's Compensation Act. The end desired result would be less controverted worker compensation claims. A detailed sectional analysis has been provided, and I would ask the Department of Labor to come forward and go through the bill with the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jackie McClintock, Director of the Workers' Compensation Division. As you stated, Mr. Chairman, the purpose of this legislation is to rectify several inconsistent and incompatible time periods that presently exist in the Act to enable the employers and their insurers to better handle and faster handle claims. Currently, the employer and its insurer has a maximum time period of 28 days to pay compensation, but only has 14 days to controvert a claim to avoid substantial penalties. A further complication is that the physician has 20 days to file a medical report, which leaves little or no time for the employer or the insurer to investigate the claim and make an informed decision.
Just one question. What is the meaning of the term controversial?
To deny. To controvert a claim is to deny a claim. And we have a notice that under the Act that calls it a notice of controversy.
Should we make committee substitute to write in the work?
No.
Yeah, we should. I think we put that in our papers.
Just while we're on that, then, let's see. I'm just reading Section 3, the Section 10, the maximum time period for an employer to file a controversy from 14 to. Under what condition would an employer want to deny a claim?
If the employee has filed a notice of injury, and let's say that there are no medical reports that have gotten in. That's
okay.
One of the things we're trying to correct,
yeah,
too.
It's a time thing.
Yeah. Or if there is a question, maybe the medical report has come in, and there's a question as to whether or not his problem, the injured worker's problem, is really related to that injury or for some other reason. There's a whole bunch of them.
I had the same problem with the word wall, so it really didn't.
In case I get my neck.
Yeah.
We'll accept it. Briefly, this legislation will require the physician to file the medical report in 14 days instead of 20. The time period to controvert a claim will be extended to 21 days instead of 14, and the maximum time period to pay a claim will be shortened from 28 days to 21 days. So in other words, the physician will file the medical report in 14 days, and the employer insurer must decide whether or not to accept or deny that claim within 21 days. The committee substitute will allow an additional grace period for the insurers to notify the employee and the board as to the payment status on a claim. This is consistent with the other changes that were made, and if it is not enacted, it will result in really unfair penalties going to the insurer and its employer. Are we glad to answer any questions?
I think that the bill basically is just making more realistic the time frames when everybody involved.
It's the only bill I can think of that does a little bit for everything. The injured worker will get paid faster, the insurer, employer has more time to investigate.
Hearing no questions, so.
Thank you.
You want to move the bill?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll move in Ash Nam's consent that we adopt the House Committee substitute for the Committee substitute for Senate Bill number 517.
I ask unanimous consent. Is there any objection? So be it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll move in Ash Nam's consent that we pass out House Committee substitute for Committee substitute for Senate Bill number 517, Labor and Commerce, with individual recommendations.
Okay. There are no objections. So be it. Yeah, this next bill is it's the National Electric Code. It's electrical code is updated every 3 years, and the 1984 code is the most recent effort in regard. The 1981 code presently in effect in the state of Alaska is therefore outdated and will not be reprinted. Adoption of the 1984 code would bring Alaska's minimum standards into conformity with those commonly accepted and used by the industry across the nation. The latest edition of the National Electrical Code is also commonly adopted by political subdivisions in the state as a minimum standard enforced under their building inspection programs. Department supports adoption of Department of Labor supports adoption of this 1984 and encourages it, and there'll be no physical impact to the department. And it's a very short adopting the 1984
Mr. Chairman, if I just made a question here, let's see here. This is we did the plumbers.
We did the plumbers.
Did we go through the same deliberation for the electrical code? It's been a while. First time we've seen this?
This is the first time.
Okay.
We're just going to adopt, make it.
You want a motion?
It was only introduced yesterday.
Oh, okay. You want a motion?
Yes.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I move and ask unanimous consent that we pass them to committee House Bill number 720, dated 5/14/84. Individual recommendation.
Hearing no objection, so be it.
This next bill is again, telephone is set up for a monologue in the evening.
Yes, this next bill that we have a teleconference set up for tomorrow with this. We have some people in Anchorage that wanted to testify and some other. And I didn't think that we would get as far through with this. And just to explain what this is all about, we have a hypothetical situation that could exist, whereas a general contractor could work on this building, say to remodel this building, and then sign a contract with a subcontractor to come in and maybe sheetrock this room, and this would normally say sheetrock and tape this room might take 3 days normally for a crew of maybe three or four people to do, but the contract subcontractor comes in here and works on it and for a month, we'll say, and then doesn't in that month period doesn't do it in a workmanship manner or that's acceptable to the building inspector or the state or whoever you was working for. And so at that time, the general contractor breaks the ties or breaks the, or notifies the subcontractor perhaps that he's not conformed and that he hasn't conformed and for one reason or another he gets someone else in here to conform. And tear this, maybe all the old work out, and have to replace it. Well, it's an unfortunate situation that certainly doesn't benefit anyone. But the bad thing about this, that it's possible that the subcontractor, if it was the owner of a subcontractor, it was an owner that was doing the work, he may be able to file, or it has been able to file in the past, to the Department of Labor for lost wages, sometimes exceeding the cost of the original contract. And For instance, if he was in here because of his incompetency or whatever reason, and like I said, to mess with the job a month, he in fact, under the present situations, could possibly be entitled to certified payroll depending on that month that it was here, even though it's just, he wasn't qualified to do the job. So the fine line, it seems to me that it's a civil matter between the contractor and the subcontractor. It should be settled. And we're trying to draft some, hold some hearings and draft some legislation that perhaps would prevent this from happening without dragging the Department of Labor into a civil matter. And I don't know just how we're going to come out, but that's the intent of this bill. And I don't know that we have some Department of Labor people here to testify today on this bill.
We could make a few comments on it. Our understanding was that it wasn't going to be...
Yeah, I didn't think that it was. If you want, we have a few minutes, or you want to come back tomorrow for the teleconference?
Mr. Chairman, I think we'd probably prefer to come back tomorrow since we're still putting in our fiscal note.
Sure, okay.
To have a comprehensive presentation.
Yeah. It's something that was brought to our attention. I'd ask the committee members, if they would, to review their file. And we have one particular horror story in there that's similar to what we have. And if perhaps by tomorrow morning, what we could.
And do we have the committee report to sign up from these last three bills in there?
Yeah.
Let's get them before we get out of here.
There's nothing else to come before the committee.
No.